Ukraine, leaving a ceasefire in the region effectively dead. Ukraine, the US and NATO accused Russia of sending troops and heavy weaponry to prop up militias in the region. But the Kremlin says there is nothing to fear, describing the repositioning of Russian armed units as a domestic issue. Analysts believe Russia's military buildup along the border with Ukraine is a response to Kiev's saber-rattling.
This buildup of Russian troops is actually, to the contrary, it is in response to saber-rattling by Ukraine that is being instigated by the United States and in the form of NATO.
The notion that Russia is responding to Ukraine's escalation does not seem far from reality. Some observers believe Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who is in a weak position at home, is playing the anti-Russian card to appease the nationalist population and mobilize support in the West. They cite a recent crackdown on pro-Russia media and figures, as well as Zelensky's public call on NATO to speed up Ukraine's membership plan. The Kremlin, which has repeatedly voiced concern over NATO's eastward expansion, bitterly opposes the notion that Ukraine could someday join the Western military alliance. After all, Biden has been one of Kiev's staunchest supporters since before the outbreak of the conflict in eastern Ukraine in 2014. This week, Biden himself pledged unwavering support to the Ukrainian government. It remains to be seen how far the new U.S. administration is ready to go in its confrontational path on Russia. If the current trajectory continues, soon we will see a full-scale war of sanctions between the two governments at the least.
World Health Day is celebrated on the 7th of April every year. For 2021, the theme is Building a Fair, Healthier World. For Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, health inequities are an everyday reality that is rooted in Israel's long-held apartheid regime. Tel Aviv has waged three wars on the blockaded enclave and maintains a crippling blockade on it since 2007. During the 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces attacked 17 hospitals and 56 health centers. The Israeli regime's inhumane practices have led to a state of de-development within Gaza's healthcare system, making it extremely hard for health workers to combat the coronavirus pandemic.
The Israeli blockade in place over the past 14 years has battered the entire health system in the Gaza Strip. Hospitals and medical centers suffer from acute shortages in medicines and medical equipment, especially amid the rapid spread of the coronavirus pandemic.
This year's World Health Day comes amid a surge in coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip. Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections in the impoverished enclave, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
On this day, we confirmed that the epidemiological situation in the Gaza Strip is very dangerous, and the curve of infections continues to increase. Everyone must take the necessary measures to safeguard their families. We also call on all concerned local and international parties to help us in fighting the pandemic.
Under international laws and norms, the Israeli regime must ensure medical supplies to Palestinians, including combating the spread of pandemics. Experts warn that the health sector in Gaza could soon collapse unless serious steps are made to remedy the situation. On World Health Day, the regime's blockade continues to undermine efforts by health workers in Gaza to provide proper medical care. This is while the situation has worsened in the besieged enclave due to the coronavirus pandemic. Ashraf Shanar, Gaza.
Around 45% of Italian firms involved in productive sectors are structurally at risk. This is one of the major findings of a new report on the competitiveness of productive sectors in Italy, released by the Bureau of Statistics Istat on Wednesday. The report warns that firms operating mostly in sectors of low technological and knowledge content would not be able to survive to a further external crisis.
The situation wasn't very much different before the COVID crisis. Italian firms were already suffering from their usual weaknesses. If these firms don't receive financial aid in the coming 3 to 4 months, they will drown. Non-food activities are suffering the most.
A series of national lockdowns to safeguard Italy's population from COVID-19 and the collapse of the health system have resulted in an economic disaster. According to the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, about 390,000 businesses shut their doors in Italy last year.
The Istat report has found tourism, arts and entertainment, and catering are among the productive sectors that have suffered with great intensity from the impact of the containment measures adopted by the Italian authorities so far.
Take-out food and delivery orders won't save my restaurant. That's all we've been allowed to do for months. Either we reopen in full or we die. We've got bills to pay.
I'm not surprised people have not yet taken to the streets to stage a revolution. I'm lucky to have my pension payments. Many, including my son, are jobless. Many went bankrupt.
Meanwhile, Italy has been swept by protests from north to south over the past days. Hospitality operators, restaurant owners, shopkeepers, street market traders are calling for reopenings as a second round of government economic support measures has been delayed. Max Civili, Rome.
Yemenis in the capital Sana'a have marched on the United Nations office in the city to slam the international community's silence in the face of Saudi's illegal acts. The protesters called for international action amid the continued detention of Yemeni oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition.
Today we have completed 2 years of protests in front of the United Nations office. We organized 730 protests to denounce the continued piracy against fuel ships. We have a 1,400-meter-long letter of condemnation signed by the Yemenis. The United Nations and the U.S. are directly observing the detention of oil vessels, and they bear responsibility for the humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
The protesters slammed the U.S. as a key partner in exacerbating the suffering of millions of Yemenis. They said Saudi Arabia's U.S.-backed siege on Yemen has caused a severe shortage of basics, including fuel, food and water, leading to numerous deaths, including among children.
Public sector employees are protesting today in front of the United Nations office because the UN bears the moral and humanitarian responsibility regarding the continued detention of oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition as it happens under the direct supervision of the UN.
Since the beginning of 2015, Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade in Yemen, depriving millions of civilians of their necessities and even hampering the humanitarian aid in the war-torn country. This has pushed the country to the brink of famine and has wrecked the healthcare system.
For 2 years now, Yemenis have been protesting outside the United Nations office in Sana'a with no tangible results. However, they say their army is now capable of forcing Saudi Arabia into listening to their voices and lift the blockade it imposed on their country. Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A joint commission session between Iran and the remaining participants of the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, comes to an end in Vienna. The sides have set up 2 expert-level working groups that are going to come up with 2 lists, one of sanctions to be lifted by the United States and the other of nuclear measures to be undertaken by Iran in order for the country to return to full compliance with the nuclear agreement. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says Tehran is not interested in any step-by-step return to the deal and is demanding the full removal of sanctions imposed, reimposed or relabeled following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA.
I have come here to do business, but I doubt that there is the same seriousness in the other side. If the U.S. is serious, they should be prepared to lift all sanctions that they have imposed or reimposed against Iran. After verification, we certainly go back to full compliance.
Iran says it has not and will not engage in any direct or indirect talks with the U.S., and it would be up to the other JCPOA signatories, namely Britain, France, Germany, China, and Russia, to talk to the Americans. The Joint Commission will meet again in Vienna on Friday to review the work of the expert groups and discuss sequence and timing. But if there's a lack of progress, Tehran says, it will end the talks. We are not in a hurry, says Iran's lead delegate. Homolezki, Vienna.
This racist, Islamophobic, misogynistic.
The daughter of a Muslim who was murdered by a white supremacist as he walked home from his local mosque has launched a campaign demanding the UK government finally adopt an Islamophobia definition. Maz Salim, whose father, Mohammed Salim, was killed by a neo-Nazi terrorist 8 years ago, has launched the campaign to highlight Islamophobic hate crimes and force the definition back on the government's agenda.
Pablo Lapchin was charged under terrorism laws. It's been 8 years now. I've been tirelessly campaigning against racism and Islamophobia. And still today, my father's name is not being mentioned in the mainstream media as an act of terrorism. And I think that's really important because whenever a Muslim is a victim, the media is very biased in the way it reports it. It's always such as lone wolf or mosque bomber. Or murderer. No, he was actually, quite frankly, a terrorist, so I want that to be highlighted. That's extremely important.
The campaign includes an online hashtag, I am Mohammed Salim, which others can use to post testimonies exposing how dangerous Islamophobia is becoming.
I've already been inundated with a lot of videos, a lot of footage, which I'm going to release every single day. And if you already look on our Twitter and our Instagram, you can see already people speaking about their experience of racism, Islamophobia and xenophobia. So if you continue to send us these videos, then we can put pressure on the government as to what is exactly happening on our streets today.
Sadly, Mohammed Salim is not the only victim. In 2015, 81-year-old Mohsin Ahmed was killed by two men in a racially motivated attack in Rotherham. And in 2017, Makram Ali was killed during the Finsbury Park terror attack during the holy month of Ramadan. In 2018, an all-party parliamentary group issued a report on anti-Muslim prejudice, which urged the government to define Islamophobia. So far, the government has refused to do so. Islamophobic attacks and racist verbal abuse are becoming near normalised here in Britain, with many Muslims complaining that it's become basically a daily occurrence. But if the government continues to refuse to acknowledge that Islamophobia is a very real and vicious form of hate crime, then preventing future attacks and also providing justice to victims will continue to get all the more harder. Robert Carter, London.
Palestinian children continue to suffer due to Israel's inhumane practices as they mark Palestinian Child Day. Israeli forces have killed and injured thousands of Palestinian children over the past decade under the watchful eye of the international community. Last year alone, Israeli forces killed 9 Palestinian children. During a press conference marking the annual event, Palestinians demanded that Israeli forces be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian children.
Israeli soldiers are acting with impunity because they feel that they will not be prosecuted for their crimes. Such policies have encouraged Israeli soldiers to violate our rights. The international community must take concrete steps to prosecute those Israeli soldiers who kill and maim us on a daily basis.
Scores of Palestinian children lost their lives during the Great March of Return peaceful rallies due to Israel's use of excessive force against peaceful protesters. According to human rights organizations, the Israeli attacks on Palestinian children were systematic.
As we mark Palestinian Child Day, Israel continues to commit grave violations against Palestinian children, including wounding them and killing them. Israel also violates the social, economic, and cultural rights. The Israeli blockade has negatively affected all aspects of life for Palestinian children in the Gaza Strip.
Since 2008, the Israeli regime waged 3 wars on the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming thousands of children. During Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces killed over 2,200 Gazans, including hundreds of children.
The Zionist enemy violates the rights of Palestinian children to live. They have bombed the homes where Palestinian children live and have deprived them from receiving proper education and health care. Palestinian children are even deprived from the right of movement.
Palestinian Child Day highlights the ongoing plight of those born under Israeli occupation and blockade.
Human rights groups have long accused the Israeli regime of deliberately targeting Palestinian children. This comes amid the failure of the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kiddie. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. and I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Greetings and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Saja. Russia has warned that it will respond to any U.S. unfriendly move. But the warning comes as the relation between the two countries is undergoing its lowest point in recent weeks, this time over Ukraine. President Vladimir Putin has accused Ukraine of provocative actions near its borders, and that while Ukraine's president has urged NATO to speed up his country's membership plan. Russia is warning NATO against deploying troops to Ukraine, arguing that the deployment would escalate tensions near its borders. The U.S. has sanctioned Russia over Ukraine, alleged interference in its elections, the poisoning of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny, and its Europe gas pipeline and support for Syria and Venezuela, among other things. Now, how will the U.S.-Russia relations look like under President Joe Biden? Are they on a collision course? Now, these questions and more in tonight's debate.
Right hand and repeat after me.
Since Joe Biden took office in the U.S., relations between Washington and Moscow have only spiraled downwards. The Biden administration has signaled a more confrontational approach towards Russia. It has already hit Moscow with economic sanctions over the jailing of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Washington has also threatened unspecified action over an alleged massive cyber attack, which it blames on Russia. Tensions have risen particularly after Biden publicly stated that he thinks Putin is a killer. Now, the Russian government says it will respond in kind to any new U.S. sanctions amid reports that the White House is about to announce further bans against Russia. This time, the source of tensions is the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Over the past 2 weeks, mainstream Western media outlets have been reporting about an increase in Russia's military presence along its borders with Ukraine. This coincides with reports of renewed clashes between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian forces in eastern Ukraine, leaving a ceasefire in the region effectively dead. Ukraine, the US and NATO accuse Russia of sending troops and heavy weaponry to prop up militias in the region. But the Kremlin says there is nothing to fear, describing the repositioning of Russian armed units as a domestic issue. Analysts believe Russia's military buildup along the border with Ukraine is a response to Kiev's saber-rattling.
This buildup of Russian troops is actually, to the contrary, it is in response to saber-rattling by Ukraine that is being instigated by the United States and in the form of NATO.
The notion that Russia is responding to Ukraine's escalation does not seem far from reality. Some observers believe Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who is in a weak position at home, is playing the anti-Russian card to appease the nationalist population and mobilize support in the West. They cite a recent crackdown on pro-Russia media and figures, as well as Zelensky's public call on NATO to speed up Ukraine's membership plan. The Kremlin, which has repeatedly voiced concern over NATO's eastward expansion, bitterly opposes the notion that Ukraine could someday join the Western military alliance. After all, Biden has been one of Kiev's staunchest supporters since before the outbreak of the conflict in eastern Ukraine in 2014. This week, Biden himself pledged unwavering support to the Ukrainian government. It remains to be seen how far the new U.S. administration is ready to go in its confrontational path on Russia. If the current trajectory continues, soon we will see a full-scale war of sanctions between the two governments at the least.
Okay, now let me invite you, our guests, to this debate show tonight. We'll have the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, Daniel McAdams, is joining us from Lake Jackson. Journalist and political commentator Don DeBar is also joining us out of New York. Good to have you with us, gentlemen. Let's go to Daniel. The Ukraine is urging NATO to speed up its country's membership plan, stoking further tensions between the U.S.-led NATO and Russia. How do you think the situation will look like in the coming weeks and months?
I think we're at an absolutely critical stage here right now. I think the danger of a full-scale war breaking out is very, very large, and part of the reason is because there is no communication. As your viewers will know, there is no Russian ambassador in the United States, and there has not been one for a couple of weeks since the statement by President Biden that Putin is a soulless killer. So the situation is terrible. Ukraine has pulled out of the Minsk talks, so it is not talking to Russia either. There is a lot of shelling going on in Donbass from the Ukrainian military, and as you point out in your report, the Russian military is putting itself in the position, as would be expected by any country, when there's unrest on the border.
Now, let me turn to New York. Don DeBar, Russia is saying it's forced to ensure its security if NATO intervenes in the conflict in East Ukraine. Now, first, will NATO deploy near the Russian border? If so, how do you think Russia would react to that deployment? You know, a senior Russian official said that Russia will defend its citizens in East Ukraine, depending on the scale of the military conflict there.
Well, first, NATO has already deployed at Russia's border. It's deployed in the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. It's deployed in Poland. It's deployed in Romania and Bulgaria. It's deployed in Turkey. It's deployed in Korea. It's not NATO, but the U.S. with THAAD missiles and such. The United States has been encircling Russia, the Soviet Union, China, since the Russian Revolution in 1917, when the U.S. invaded along with some of the Western European countries to try to take down the revolutionary government in 1917. Taking down the government of that real estate since then has been the largest project in human history, if you're going to look at how much money was spent. More money was spent building up the U.S. military in order to have the outcome that they got in 1991 with the takedown and dismantling of the Soviet Union than was spent on any other project in human history. So there's something very attractive about that real estate and about the potential competition that comes out of that part of the world that is the focus of the elite here since modern time. Russia stepped onto the world stage in the wake of World War I. I think that if you were to look at a map of deployed troops and look at the fact that from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula, the U.S. has troops deployed, whether it's with NATO or other alliances or just outright occupation, it's pretty clear what NATO's goal is. And if you look at a reciprocal map, you don't see a single Russian or Chinese military base in the Western Hemisphere, let alone at the U.S. borders. So that, you know, the idea that we need to expand our presence at Russia's borders in order to protect against some kind of Russian aggression, it's not only laughable, it's delusional.
Okay. Now, Daniel, there are some observers who are saying that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is in a weak position on the home turf, so he's playing this anti-Russia card thing. What's your take?
He's playing a very dangerous game, and it does harken back to 2008 when the Bush administration led Saakashvili in Georgia to believe that NATO had his back if he started bellicose actions in the region. He took that sign incorrectly, and he went into South Ossetia, and of course the Russians responded very quickly and very forcefully. We are seeing that kind of similar situation play out. The U.S. leadership, from the President to the Secretary of State to the Secretary of Defense, are speaking with one voice. It's a very, very carefully crafted message, which is that we support the territorial integrity of Ukraine. What that means to them is Crimea and the Donbass. And Zelensky is definitely taking that message. What do they really mean? Does Biden really mean, well, is Biden in charge, but do they really mean that the U.S. is ready to risk a nuclear war with Russia over a small island in the region? That's the big question. The whole thing was started, was really sped up with the last month's presidential declaration by Zelensky, I think it was 1/17/2021, where he declared it the strategy of Ukraine to militarily retake Crimea and Sevastopol. That set things in motion, and of course we had just a couple of weeks ago a massive U.S. airlift of military equipment to Ukraine. So the U.S. is playing along. There are no cooler heads right now to prevail, and I would say we're careening toward disaster in the region.
Mm-hmm. Now, Don, the U.S. quit a number of major agreements with Russia, you know, including the 1987 INF, Strategic Arms Control Treaty, and also we had this Open the Skies Agreement. So what signal did Washington send Moscow by making such decisions?
That's a complex set of facts, actually. Some of, you know, we've had, we'll take a look at, say the period then it refers to, for example, with, you know, a similar scenario playing out in Georgia in 2007, 2008, was the Bush administration. And as reckless as the foreign policy was of the neocons under Bush, there was some restraint. And when it came to pushing and shoving around Russia, they did not use a heavy hand. And so the threat of plenty heavy hand involved. A lot of that unrest was, you know, CIA craft work. And so, you know, Russia could have said, you guys are here, you know, creating terrorists on our soil. You know, we're going to blow up New York or whatever. That's not the response that they got. It was handled well by both sides, considering the ridiculous situation that they were in. But in the Obama administration, these same neocons and some of the others that joined them, even in some marriages, if you look at Vicki Nuland and Samantha Power and Susan Rice, the situation was much more reckless in terms of some of the things that happened. You had shootdowns of Russian planes by Turkey, for example.
Right.
You know, if Russia had responded to that, NATO, Article 5 would require that, you know, if the Russians shoot down a Turkish plane, Turkey's a NATO ally, the U.S. and Russia are now in a state of war. And so what's happening is you have a country that has a history, not really even as a country, more as a crossroads, civilizational crossroads, where the Poles, Lithuanians, Russians, and others in that area sort of lived in their own enclaves, was mashed into a 20th century state due to the things that happened around it, that's settling into some kind of stasis now. The eastern part of the country, they're Russians. It's part of Russia. Kiev, which is in the western part, even though it's, you know, more Polish and Lithuanian and Silesian, that was one of the first Russian cities. Suddenly, NATO is going to join that to its gang, and anything that happens, this internecine fight that's going on inside Ukraine, all of a sudden carries with it Article 5, which means war with Russia because two groups of Ukrainians were shooting at each other. Mm-hmm. You only walk into a situation like that because that's what you intended to do. This policy was abandoned by Trump. We were wargaming that whole front from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula constantly through both Obama administrations. Trump turned that off, and they've started that up again, and they started right away with a new crisis in Ukraine, and we're looking down the barrel of a gun at perhaps a war with Russia, which is insanity.
Okay. Now, Daniel, there are some observers who say that it seems that Washington is deliberately seeking to escalate tensions with Russia. And Don was also referring to it in some way, especially just after Biden publicly called Putin a killer. Do you also see that in that light?
Well, absolutely. Let's not forget, as was just mentioned, the The same people who are now recycling this tension over Ukraine are the people that were in the center of the U.S. coup in 2014. This is where everything comes from, and this is why a non-interventionist U.S. foreign policy is much superior to interventionism, because this has been an opening, open festering wound since 2014, mm-hmm. when we must remind ourselves the United States government overthrew a democratically elected government in Ukraine. So much for the rules-based international order. But this has been a festering wound. Thousands have died, and now the same people are returning to the scene of the crime to revisit the crime scene and to finish the killing that they started back in 2014. That's the real danger. These people are literally unhinged. And that was, as was said previously, for all of his faults, and there were plenty of them. At least Trump didn't go down this insane path that these neocons and humanitarian interventionists, so-called, the neoliberals, that they're going into with Ukraine.
Now, Don, how far do you think that the U.S. administration is ready to go on this confrontational path vis-a-vis Russia?
Well, first of all, and Daniel started to make reference to this, but let's be clear about what we mean. That when we say U.S. administration, in the case of this administration, it has a different meaning than perhaps any in history before. Although people have always known that the real power, sitting at the top of this megillah called the United States of America, is slightly off stage. It is not really in the hands of the president or the Congress, that there's some, you know, other power that's involved that has influence over those offices. Joe Biden is not acting as president. He is literally an administrator. And that the people that placed him in that office, that had that as a project from the moment the 2016 election was over, they have very clear policy objectives with respect to Russia, which they were practicing during the Obama administration, and that they were accusing Trump of aiding and abetting by being elected and not continuing a warlike posture towards Russia. If you'll recall, the New York Times was carrying editorials calling for him to be impeached and tried for treason.
Right.
Treason for the relationship with Russia, which was by no means, you know, it wasn't like you had them doing shots of Stolichnaya like they used to do with Reagan and, you know, some of Reagan's aides back in the early 80s during that phase of the Cold War. And you had, in addition to that, to make it clear that policy was coming from somewhere besides the White House, shortly after Trump was elected, Congress, sui sponte, on its own initiative, to telegraph to Trump exactly how much power he had with respect to relations with Russia, imposed sanctions on Russia, Iran, and DPRK, on North Korea, mm-hmm. by a vote of something like 517-6 or something. Not only veto-proof, but almost unanimous. And this was at a time when the president was establishing a foreign policy, when Trump was establishing a foreign policy, and making signals towards Russia that, look, I'd like to back up a little bit and cool things out and see if we can sit down and make some deals. So that, you know, Trump was thrown out his whole time in office. He was impeached over Ukraine.
Right.
The whole narrative was Russia, that somehow Russia had taken over the United States by placing Trump in office. Well, they have power now. They have a guy that signs whatever they put in front of them. They're moving towards Russia aggressively. And they have said many, many, many times, look, if anybody rises as a challenge to us, we have to smack them down. Well, China's economy is registering as a global challenge, and China and Russia are behaving as strategic partners, and they have said that they're strategic partners. Mm-hmm. And if you look at our military forces, the Western military forces, what they're aimed at, they are all aimed at Russia and China. That builds an alliance between them, you know, of our doing.
Yeah, it's growing.
That is driving policy here.
Okay. And Daniel, what are the possible outcomes of the U.S. confrontational approach on Russia, in your opinion?
Well, it depends on how far they're willing to go. And Don makes a good point, which is that Biden really is not in charge. That's pretty clear. And actually, that should terrify people, because with all of his faults, and Obama let a lot of things go on underneath him that were quite bad. He was quite a warmonger. However, I do think he exercised kind of a mitigating presence over the more hawkish people in his administration. We don't have that. The brakes are off of this train right now, and the Russians are very clear on this. This is Ukraine is a red line for them. You know, Dmitry Kozak said, I think today, that if Ukraine provokes a war, if Ukraine attacks, it'll be the beginning of the end of Ukraine, and that Russia may be required to come to the aid of its residents in Donbass. So that is very clear, and Russia understands now, like they did not understand in 2014, that the U.S. is not a partner, that the U.S. is not a rational actor. The U.S. makes deals that it doesn't keep. We know that with the Iranian nuclear deal. You cannot negotiate with the United States. They understand this now, and they're going to play the game very differently this next time. If, God forbid, it comes to this, they're going to play very differently because they have a lot more knowledge about the irrationality of the United States as an actor on the global stage.
Okay. All right, on that note, we come to the end of this debate. Let me thank our guests. We had Executive Director of Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, Daniel McAdams in Lake Jackson, and journalist and political commentator Don DeBar joined us out of New York. Up in your host, Behrouz Nejef.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. According to a Reuters tally, it took more than a year for the global coronavirus death toll to reach 2 million. The next 1 million deaths were added in about 3 months. We have prepared for you an article written by staff writers of the Reuters news agency. The piece is titled, WHO Says Inequitable Global Vaccinations Against Coronavirus a Travesty. Please stay with us to hear more of the Reuters article. The head of the World Health Organization said recently it is a travesty that some countries still have not had enough access to vaccines to begin inoculating healthcare workers and the most vulnerable people in their societies against COVID-19. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus told a news conference, "Scaling up production and equitable distribution remains the major barrier to ending the acute stage of the COVID-19 pandemic." WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus added, "It's a travesty that in some countries, health workers and those at-risk groups remain completely unvaccinated." The President of Namibia, Hage Geingob, one of the several world leaders invited to address the World Health Organization news conference for World Health Day, decried vaccine apartheid, under which some countries were forced to wait while others received vaccine doses. The president of Namibia, Hage Geingob, said Namibia had received vaccines from our friends, India and China, but was still waiting for other vaccines despite having paid a deposit for them. WHO's Director General Tedros said Namibia would receive some vaccines from the World Health Organization co-led COVAX program in around 2 weeks' time. It comes as, according to a Reuters tally, coronavirus-related deaths worldwide have crossed the 3 million mark, As the latest global resurgence of COVID-19 infections is challenging vaccination efforts across the globe. Worldwide, coronavirus deaths are rising once again, especially in Brazil and India. Health officials blame more infectious variants of the virus that were first detected in the United Kingdom and South Africa, along with public fatigue with lockdowns and other restrictions. According to a Reuters tally, it took more than a year for the global coronavirus death toll to reach 2 million. The next 1 million deaths, though, were added in about 3 months. According to a Reuters analysis, Brazil is leading the world in the daily average number of new deaths reported and accounts for one in every four deaths worldwide each day. The World Health Organization acknowledged the nation's dire condition due to coronavirus, saying, "Brazil is in a very critical condition with an overwhelmed healthcare system." World Health Organization epidemiologist Maria van Kerkhove told the briefing recently, "Indeed, there is a very serious situation going on in Brazil right now, where we have a number of states in critical condition." She said that many hospital intensive care units are more than 90% full. India reported a record rise in COVID-19 infections, becoming the second nation after the United States to post more than 100,000 new cases in a day. India's worst affected state, Maharashtra, began shutting shops, shopping malls, cinemas, bars, restaurants, and places of worship as hospitals are being overrun by patients. The European region, which includes 51 countries, has the highest total number of deaths at nearly 1.1 million. Five European countries, including the United Kingdom, Russia, France, Italy, and Germany, constitute about 60% of Europe's total coronavirus-related deaths. The United States of America has the highest number of deaths of any country in the world at 555,000 and accounts for about 19% of all deaths due to COVID-19 globally. Cases have risen for the last 3 weeks, but health officials believe the nation's rapid vaccination campaign may prevent a rise in death numbers. A third of the population has received at least one dose of a vaccine. According to latest figures from research and data provider firm Our World in Data, at least 370.3 million people, or nearly 4.75% of the global population, had received a single dose of COVID-19 vaccine by Sunday, 4th of April. However, the World Health Organization is urging countries to donate more doses of approved COVID-19 vaccines to help meet vaccination targets for the most vulnerable in poorer countries. Moreover, several European countries are considering mixing up COVID-19 vaccines for citizens who received a first dose of AstraZeneca's shot, an unprecedented move that highlights challenges for governments struggling to tame fresh rises in the number of infections. Vaccination programs have been upset after a small number of reports that recipients of the AstraZeneca inoculation have suffered extremely rare blood clots, leading some countries worldwide to suspend its use out of caution. A senior official for the European Medicines Agency, EMA, said in an interview published recently, there was a link between the AstraZeneca vaccine and rare blood clots in the brain, but the possible causes were still unknown. The European Medicines Agency, EMA, later said in a statement that its review of the vaccine of the AstraZeneca vaccine was ongoing. EMA said it gave an update on its investigation on Wednesday afternoon, 7th of April. AstraZeneca has said previously its studies have found no higher risk of blood clots because of the vaccine, millions of doses of which have been administered worldwide. While many countries have resumed using the vaccine shot, some have imposed age restrictions. In many instances, this has left officials scratching their heads over what to do for people who received a first dose of AstraZeneca vaccine but are no longer eligible under the new rules. While the numbers are small compared with the tens of millions being inoculated across the region, the decision is significant because it has not been tested in late-stage human trials. Any divergence to the European Medicines Agency's marketing authorization would also be considered as off-label use, meaning it would not be approved by the regulator and leave individual countries responsible for any possible side effects. The European Medicines Agency, EMA, had no immediate comment when asked about mixing and matching vaccines and referred to the briefing that was given on Wednesday, 7th of April. Some experts say that because all of the vaccines target the same outer spike protein of the coronavirus, they could work together to train the body to fight off the virus. There is no evidence it will be as effective. Germany was the first European country to recommend on 1st of April that people under the age of 60 who have had a first AstraZeneca vaccine shot should receive a different product for their second vaccine dose. Norway will decide whether to resume using AstraZeneca's vaccine or rely on alternatives by 15th of April. Sarah Vixmoen Watler, a senior physician at the Norwegian Institute of Public Health, told the Reuters news agency, "The outcome is either you get one vaccine, the AstraZeneca vaccine, or you get a booster vaccine with other types of vaccines." Norwegian health authorities are also waiting for the results of a British trial launched in February to explore mixing doses of Pfizer and AstraZeneca vaccines. The timing of the data is not known. Britain said late last year that it would allow people to be given shots of different COVID-19 vaccines on rare occasions, but it has not yet had to do so. Meanwhile, Finland, which resumed using the AstraZeneca vaccine from 29th of March, but will only give it to people aged 65 and over, said it would wait for the European Medicines Agency's conclusions before making a recommendation. It will have to start giving second doses of the vaccine by mid-April. In France, where the AstraZeneca vaccine can now only be used for those aged 55 or older, the issue affects hundreds of thousands of people. According to two sources aware of the organization's plans, a top health advisory body in charge of defining the use of vaccines, the Haute Autorité de la Santé, or HAS, is also contemplating deploying a messenger RNA or mRNA vaccine produced by Pfizer-BioNTech or Moderna as a second dose. However, one of the sources added, a formal decision has not yet been taken, as experts await more data, notably from Britain. France has until early May, which marks 12 weeks after the first doses were administered. The Haute Autorité de la Santé, or HAS, had no comment. Back in February, it said there was no data to assess interchangeability of AstraZeneca's vaccine and therefore advised that those who have already received a first dose of the vaccine should not get a different shot when vaccinated for the second time. Charlotte Seneschal, a 52-year-old hospital nurse working in Strasbourg in eastern France, said, We're left guessing, and that makes me and other colleagues feel very uncomfortable.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.